Let me begin, and so let's just begin with the key word, world literature itself. And as we all know, because I'm sure that being students of literature, being advanced students of literature, you do know that the word world literature, or rather Weltliteratur, was first popularized, if not coined, probably coined also, who knows, by Goethe. And Goethe talked about precisely this possibility that we cannot restrict ourselves to national literatures anymore. And this was almost 200 years back, and the problem probably still persists. And this is actually, he apparently told one of his disciples, who was called Johann Peter Eckermann, in January 1827 that, and I quote Goethe, "I'm more and more convinced that poetry," he talks about poetry, but we can kind of metonymize it into literature in general, "is the universal position of mankind, revealing itself everywhere and at all times in hundreds of them. Therefore, I therefore like to look about me in foreign nations and advise everyone to do the same. National literature is now a rather unmeaning term. The epoch of world literature is at hand, and everyone must strive to hasten its approach." So right at the beginning, when world literature, the term world literature gets kind of circulated, we already have this dichotomy, therefore, drawn in between national literatures, which it seems more and more difficult to live up to, and this embracing of the world. But while Goethe apparently told his disciple Johann Peter Eckermann this thing, this was not the first published instance of Goethe talking about world literature. In January 1827 itself, because this particular advice, so to say, off the record, off the cuff, verbal advice, was published only in 1835. But in 1827, January itself, Goethe had already written an article, and in which he basically kind of compared a couple of French plays and his own play too, and wherein this was the first published instance in January 1827 itself, where Goethe used the term world literature. So the first published instance was also in 1827. What is interesting, however, is that when we look at this first published instance, so the first verbal instance is where Goethe almost kind of poses against national literatures and talks about embracing the world. But in this first published instance, we find that peculiarly, Goethe also betrays some kind of a nationalist pride, leading to this possibility of a coexistence, as it were, between nationalism and a certain world-embracing cosmopolitanism. So if we look at this first published instance, again, January 1827, where Goethe had used the word world literature, he says, peculiarly it would seem, "There is being formed a universal world literature in which an honorable role is reserved for us Germans. All the nations review our work. They praise, censure, accept and reject, imitate and misrepresent us, open or close their hearts to us. All this we must accept, etc., etc." So there is also, right from the beginning, we see this kind of a peculiar conundrum between what would be very nationalistic and what would apparently precisely transcend that nationalistic spirit forms the very crux of world literature. And in another article, and which is also where Goethe talks about world literature, and which is actually his essay on a German translation of Carlyle's Life of Schiller, Goethe also similarly writes, so once again showing that how even when he was doing comparative literature or advocating comparative literature, there was this strong sense in him of somehow putting the German nationalist spirit first. So he goes on to say in another article, he says, "The wide world, extensive as it is only an expanded fatherland." So earlier we thought that the dichotomy was precisely between the provincial nationalistic fatherland and this wide world. And of course that we cannot be tied to the fatherland only anymore. But it also seems peculiarly that Goethe, in his general build-up of the theory of world literature, however, brings in the nationalistic idea of the fatherland too. And that's ultimately, it's all German. The vantage point seems to be all German. And he goes on to say, and will, if looked at aright, be able to give us no more than what our home soil can endow us with also. So is it that ultimately world literature should be able to get rid of provincialisms and bring us face to face with a certain global cosmopolitanism? Or is it that one is still looking for that nationalistic spirit, only expanded perhaps, in doing world literature? This particular debate and how Goethe's notion of world literature continuously therefore strives between nationalism and cosmopolitanism has been analyzed by many, and this is a book, an article that is worth looking into, and which is in David Damrosch's World Literature in Theory, which is a book that probably all of you are familiar with, where how Goethe continuously kind of straddles between these two poles is brought out fairly well. Now, this is one instance of the term world literature, one of those earliest instances of the term world literature being introduced. And we already see a certain debate, therefore, emerging between cosmopolitanism on the one hand, though that word hasn't been used yet, and nationalism on the other hand. In a second instance, which is also one of those proto-instances of the term world literature being coined and used, and which again, since I presume that most of you are familiar with world literature per se, is of course Marx and Engels in Communist Manifesto, which is two decades after Goethe's, the particular articles of Goethe that we were talking about. And here in the Communist Manifesto, Marx and Engels famously talk about world literature, and they go on to say, and there are a couple of points that we must unpack here. Marx and Engels say, the need of a constantly expanding market for its products chases the bourgeoisie over the whole surface of the globe. The bourgeoisie has, through its exploitation of the world market, given a cosmopolitan character to production and consumption in every country. And as in material, so also in intellectual production, the intellectual creations of individual nations become common property. National one-sidedness and narrow-mindedness become more and more impossible, and from the numerous national and local literatures, there arises a world literature. So now this is again a two-sided sword, as it were, because on the one hand, clearly, Marx and Engels do show that world literature potentially takes people beyond narrow-mindedness and beyond. So that part is there. So evidently, world literature is supposed to take you beyond narrow-mindedness. But they also ascribe the word cosmopolitan in this quote to what would be a very problematic relationship between bourgeois world capitalism. So, somehow, it's world capitalism, it's the expansion of capitalism all over the world that somehow is leading to this particular cosmopolitan project called world literature. So, the whole idea of worlding or cosmopolitanism is not altogether unproblematic, because it's almost, I mean, while on one hand, it clearly rids us of provincialisms, narrow-mindednesses, but on the other hand, it's also intrinsically tied with the very expansion of capital all over the globe, a proto-globalization of sorts. So in short, in these two first instances of bringing the word world literature, the phrase world literature to the fore, Goethe's as well as Marx and Engels's, we find that somehow world literature is not a seamless terrain, because it continuously poses itself against narrow provincialisms, against narrow nationalisms, but then it betrays nationalism too, as it did in the case of Goethe, or it also shows the very problematic side of a certain centralized cosmopolitanism, which is global capital driven. So this is what we must keep at the back of our mind, because this is exactly what my talk will therefore want to traverse. Now, after this initiation into world literature, it seems the term world literature would have taken a relative back seat, and maybe the term comparative literature, which almost is the same, would have taken over. And comparative literature has itself a rather long history, the phrase comparative literature, but I'll just breeze through these points, because as early as 1598, we first find the word, not exactly comparative literature, but comparative discourse on poets emerges. Even as early as 1774, we find comparative survey of poetry as a phrase being offered by Thomas Warton. And in 1790, we have the phrase comparative criticism, etc. And in French, the term littérature comparée, which is not comparative literature, I mean, as you'd know, but literature compared, that we find emerges in French. And in French, again, very early in 1826 itself, so roughly around the same point of time that Goethe was coining his his coined his phrase world literature, we find that someone called Charles Pujon, he goes on to talk about how comparative literature is the kind of literature, the preferred mode of studying literature. But so far, so good. I mean, this is more of a proto-history of the phrase comparative literature. And this is important because soon we would find comparative literature and world literature almost become interchangeable. But the phrase comparative literature as such, and not literature compared, not comparative criticism, etc., that gets coined by Matthew Arnold, the famous Victorian poet Matthew Arnold, and who in 1848, apparently, in a letter to his sister, and this letter wasn't published till 1895, so again, just like Goethe's verbal comment, the first use of the phrase comparative literature was again in a letter which was published only much later. But in this letter to his sister, Matthew Arnold seemed to have coined the phrase comparative literature. And he goes on to say, of course, peculiarly, in just the reverse way that Goethe would have, because Goethe's foray into world literature almost suggested to him the superiority of German literature. But if we go through the quote, though that is quite an aside, because that's not really part of my argument here, but he goes on to say that if we attend to comparative literatures in the last 50 years, we would see that England is far behind the continent. So Matthew Arnold's take on comparative literature paradoxically invokes the idea of the nation to only show that the English are probably inferior to the Germans or the French or whosoever. But that's quite besides the point. So in 1848, in a letter, Matthew Arnold first coined the term comparative literature, but since it was published much later, the first published treatise, the first published instance of Matthew Arnold using the word comparative literature, and therefore the definitional parameter that he invokes here becomes important, was in 1857 in his inaugural lecture at Oxford. Matthew Arnold became a professor of poetry at Oxford. He goes on to say, and I quote, "No single event, no single literature is adequately comprehended except in relation to other events, to other literatures." And that is his almost clinical definition of comparative literature. That is, we have to continuously compare all single literatures to other literatures. Now, so far, so good. And we would find that the first book that bears the title Comparative Literature was published in 1886 by someone called Hutchison Macaulay-Posnett. And in that book, so the first book that bears the title Comparative Literature, which is called Comparative Literature, came out in 1886, and wherein Posnett also talks about a similar issue. And he says, and I'm quoting from this book, "The gradual expansion of social life from clan to city, from city to nation, from both of these to cosmopolitan humanity as the proper order of our studies in comparative literature." So once again, we find that this whole nation to cosmopolitanism, nation versus cosmopolitanism, this move, as it were, from nationalism or national concerns to an apparent cosmopolitan humanity seems to be the mandate of comparative literature. But we have already problematized this dichotomy, this dyad, and it doesn't seem that one necessarily displaces the other, because the two are kind of caught up in a double bind, and that has been exactly the point. And to unpack this particular double bind that cosmopolitanism and nationalism has, I will now take you through a brief detour, as it were, not much of a detour, I wouldn't spend much time on it, but to understand this this dyad, cosmopolitanism and nationalism, and I'll go through three or four people who seem to have really theorized this connection between cosmopolitanism and nationalism. First, of course, Kant, and as we all know, in his essay Perpetual Peace, and wherein his 1795 essay, Kant first tried to theorize cosmopolitanism vis-a-vis nationalism, and he brings up this whole theory of hospitality. And his idea was that as trade and commercial relationships between nation-states increase, war will become a thing of the past, and we'll have perpetual peace, because the need for economic growth will require nations to be hospitable to each other, leading to a certain kind of mutual tolerance and cosmopolitanism. That was Kant's wishful thinking way back in 1795, that we won't have war anymore. But what is interesting is that in this particular book, he also defines hospitality, since being hospitable, nations being hospitable to each other, is the crux, therefore, of how cosmopolitanism has to be propped up amongst nations. He defines hospitality too. It's a longish quote I will not take you through, but the crux of this quote is that Kant defines hospitality extremely conditionally. And it seems that ultimately the idea is that nation states are hospitable to each other, and therefore by extension, people are also hospitable to each other. But this hospitality is conditional insofar as the nation state still has its discretion, as it were, to determine who it wants to be hospitable to and who it doesn't want to be hospitable to. In fact, this is precisely the point that, to move on to my second kind of key thinkers, S within bracket, because Derrida and Saila Ben-Habib almost talk in a similar singular voice. So this is exactly what is pointed out by Derrida, for instance, in numerous works where he talks about hospitality. Given another occasion, we could have talked in detail about Derrida's notion of hospitality. But today one is talking only in the relation that Derrida raises vis-a-vis Kant. So Derrida points out that somehow Kant's notion, and again I will not quote because one doesn't have that kind of time, but Derrida points out that Kant's notion of cosmopolitanism is extremely conditional. And somehow he says that both the Hellenic and the Hebraic traditions of hospitality, they seem to have been far more unconditional. And with Kant, we enter into some kind of a conditional hospitality and conditional cosmopolitanism. So once again, cosmopolitanism, which however is not the antithesis of nationalism, but rather very much dependent on the nation state still playing the agential role. And this is exactly what Saila Ben-Habib, she has this wonderful book and something that one must look up, and this is my suggestion as well as prescription maybe, Another Cosmopolitanism. It's an old book now, it was published in 2006, well, old as in not that old, but nevertheless, Another Cosmopolitanism, where Saila Ben-Habib precisely picks up this thread. And her suggestion is that there is one kind of cosmopolitanism that is nation-driven, the kind of cosmopolitanism that probably Kant talks about, and where cosmopolitanism does not really get rid of nationalism. Whereas there is a possibility, there is another kind of cosmopolitanism where somehow, she goes on to say that there is the possibility of another kind of cosmopolitanism where the nation state does not play the determining role. Again, since we are not exactly talking about hospitality here or how modes of hospitality can be derived but from the nation state, I will not go into any greater detail here, but move on in talking about the same connection between cosmopolitanism and nationalism. So in short, just to kind of have a brief recap here, we discovered that to talk about world literature or to talk about comparative literature, we apparently have to transcend national boundaries and talk about the world as such, which almost entails a certain cosmopolitanism. But we also saw that this cosmopolitanism is itself not really bereft of nationalism or national concerns themselves. And on the contrary, this cosmopolitanism itself might be fraught with certain problems of somehow the first world, the globalizing, capitalizing, hegemon of the first world being somehow in hold of the reins of such a cosmopolitanism, as we saw through Marx and Engels. And this is what therefore wants us to probably fight shy of both nationalism and cosmopolitanism, rather than fall in for the easy lure of a certain kind of cosmopolitanism, a certain kind of first world driven cosmopolitanism as opposed to nationalism. And herein, my third author, and whom after having introduced in this context, the context of nationalism versus cosmopolitanism, I will really dwell on much more because he'll form the backbone of our discussion today, is Tagore. Rabindranath Tagore, who you must have heard of, and that's my presumption, a Bengali author, an Indian author if one wishes to call him so, and who wrote primarily towards the beginning of the 20th century. And Tagore has this wonderful set of essays, a collection of three essays called Nationalism, which was published in 1917, and it's originally in English. And all of Tagore's works are available freely online in this particular site called tagoreweb.in. And that is where I have also, in the quotes that I'll present before you, sourced his essay too. So Tagore Tagore takes a very interesting position vis-a-vis nationalism and cosmopolitanism, and which could be a stepping stone, therefore, into the debate that we are having. He says in this particular essay, this particular collection of essays, Nationalism, that neither, and these are all quotes from Tagore, neither the colorless vagueness of cosmopolitanism nor the fierce self-idolatry of nation worship is the goal of human history. So it's not really posing a certain kind of cosmopolitanism, which could be dilettante, which could be vague, which could be necessarily first world, capital-driven, globalization-driven, as Marx and Engels pointed out, nor. So it's not a question of either or. It's not a question of to be non-nationalistic or to be beyond provincial in literary scholarship. One must necessarily embrace a certain kind of cosmopolitanism. In fact, it could be neither. In fact, Tagore's scathing critique of nationalism is something that many of you are probably, I don't expect many of you to be aware of it. I mean, that would be true for an Indian audience probably. But I have just picked up some choicest quotes from Tagore's nationalism to show how much of a scathing critic of nationalism he was. So according to him, he goes on to say that the nation is the greatest evil for nation. So Tagore really thought that nationalism is the ultimate evil. And it is really, really, it's bad. Nothing can be as bad as nationalism. And nationalism is indeed a very bad thing. And Tagore does believe nationalism is a great menace. It is the particular thing which for years has been at the bottom of India's troubles. And a scathing critique of nationalism continues. And I could probably keep on quoting from Tagore and Tagore's strong diatribe against nationalism. And some of these quotes are so tempting to read out aloud that in spite of me being mindful of time, I cannot really resist the temptation of. He talks about the idea of the nation as being an anesthetic. It numbs you. And he says, and the idea of the nation is one of the most powerful anesthetics that man has invented. Under the influence of its fumes, the whole people can carry out its systematic program of the most virulent self-seeking without being in the least aware of its moral perversion. In fact, feeling dangerously resentful if it is pointed out. Similarly, I mean, just like nationalism is an anesthetic, he talks about how a nation, the idea of the nation, has always thrived upon mutilated humanity. It makes puppets out of human beings. And he talks about, and very interestingly, in a direct kind of dialogue with Kant, who would have written a century before him. We talked about Perpetual Peace a little while back. He goes on to say, you say these machines will come into an agreement for their mutual protection based upon a conspiracy of fear? But will this federation, you say, okay, I kind of put an interrogative tone to what is otherwise an assertive sentence, but will this federation of steam boilers supply you with a soul? And so Tagore is much more concerned about soul rather than what we already thought was wishful thinking on Kant's part, that apparently nations will come to an agreement of perpetual peace. But anyway, Tagore's general critique of nationalism and the fact that India has never had a real sense of nationalism and we should not be idolatrous of the nation and etc., etc., that the nation is as inhuman as it gets, it continues. But the real point that I wanted to bring before you was that as critical of the nation as Tagore may be, he equally poses himself against the vagueness of cosmopolitanism. And this is what I'd like to draw your attention to, because as I said, in the next quite a few minutes, for the bulk of my talk, as it were, I would primarily deal with Tagore's views on world literature, and because Tagore has quite a lot to say on world literature, from Goethe and Marx and Engels through comparative literature, we are now moving into the possibility of conceiving world literature that somehow fights shy not only of nationalism, but also vague cosmopolitanism. And what is that then? What kind of a template of world literature do we have then? Interestingly, Tagore was asked to deliver a lecture on comparative literature by the National Council of Education in Calcutta in February 1907. And what he delivered, the lecture that he delivered, it got published in 1907 itself as World Literature. And you will find a very interesting English translation of this, again in David Damrosch, the book that I've already cited from, which is almost a source book, as it were, with numerous extracts from numerous authors downtime on world literature. So an English translation is available in David Damrosch's World Literature and Theory, as chapter 4 in David Damrosch's World Literature and Theory. But in the quotes that I'll present before you, to try to build up the particular template of world literature that Tagore constructs, I will rely on my own translations. Since I would have read Tagore in the original in Bengali, I thought that there's no point in relying on a derived translation, which would problematize translation itself. So the quotations that I would use are my own translations. Very interestingly, in this lecture, Tagore simply says, and this is a conflation that we have also made between comparative literature and world literature. Tagore simply says, what you have named as comparative literature in English, I will call world literature in Bengali. So it's as if world literature and comparative literature are indeed interchangeable terms. And probably they are. But what I'm much more interested in is not whether comparative literature and world literature are synonymous, but what are these points that Tagore makes about world literature? What is the mandate of world literature? And accordingly, I have a kind of distilled from this particular article on world literature, 7 points, one after the other. And these 7 points, so what is world literature according to Tagore? What is the template of world literature? We'll find that Tagore builds up a thesis about world literature on 7 points. And the first point is literature versus work. What he distinguishes as work, utility-driven work. And herein, I kind of transition into my previous lecture, because all the points that I'd raised today will seem to be somehow resonant of what we talked about in the last class. So Tagore says, and for the next several minutes, I'll primarily be quoting Tagore, because there's no better way of me to present Tagore's views before you, but to quote him through my translation of his Bengali, original Bengali work. So the first distinction that Tagore makes is between literature and work. So he says, there are two major streams in which human beings express themselves in this world. One stream comprises the work that humans do. The other stream is that of literature. So he clearly distinguishes between work and literature. And he goes on to say, these two streams flow right next to each other. Human beings have dedicated themselves to both of these, compositions through labor and compositions through imagination. We have to try to know the history and literature of humankind through these two flows respectively. So the first thing that we must understand is that literature is not work, according to Tagore. Literature precisely stands as the other of what is utility-driven, what is utility-oriented. And he goes on to say, in the sphere of work, human beings expend all their energy and experience to build homes, societies, states, and religious communities. It is through these buildings that all that human beings know, all that they have achieved, and all that they still desire get expression. And gradually it has come to such a pass that no sovereign individual can express himself or herself clearly and wholly anymore, but through the prism of home, society, state, and religion built by many people over many years. And obviously the rhetorical thrust of this quote is that unfortunately we get cocooned, therefore, in these markers of home, society, state, while literature stands precisely as the other of this. And he goes on to say, that which is great in human beings, that which is eternal, that which cannot be exhausted in everyday work, is what gets captured in literature. So literature is always in excess of work, and therefore by definition always on the outside of such markers like state, society, etc. And it automatically builds up the great form of the human race. Accordingly, therefore, and this we move on to the second point, the second, and again it is resonant of what we were talking about in the last class. According to Tagore, therefore, the mandate of literature is wasteful expenditure. as opposed to, and Tagore was writing three decades before Bataille, who we mentioned in the last class, when in the last lecture we talked about wasteful expenditure and excesses. The reference point was Georges Bataille, as you'd remember, but Tagore in 1907 already said how wasteful expenditure needs to be the precise mandate of literature. And he's talking about world literature, so not just literature. If we have to have something called world literature, it has to be tied against work, to against utility-driven work, to rather wasteful expenditure. And it says, and it gives two fantastic examples, one after the other, one of a mother and the other of a domestic mistress is a weird translation by me, but probably the closest that I could come to, but someone who manages a household, so to say. He gives two examples, one after the other. He goes on to say, a mother cannot help taking care of a little child, but she expresses a love not only through routine work for the child, but also through spontaneous gestures, which have no purpose. They express themselves through so many games she plays with the child, so many cuddles of affection that she showers on it, so many meaningless babbles that she utters to it. She dresses up the child in many colors, decks it with many ornaments, and without any need or purpose, cannot but expand her love and duty for the child to meaningless but beautiful excessive expenditure. And of course, this is an analogy, and he tries to build a similar case for literature itself. So the idea is, just like a mother does not only do what is utility driven for the child, but also pets the child, calls the child by certain names. Similarly, the second analogy that he gives is of the domestic mistress, and herein he also talks about gift and the idea of the proper gifts, again to invoke a very Bataillean vocabulary, where you outgift each other, you completely exhaust yourself, almost sacrifice yourself to be able to outgift the one who gifted something to you. So, and at the cost of, tremendous cost of material wastefulness. Anyway, since the point is roughly the same, and since one has to do well with time, one can probably skip this code. But here in a similar analogy, from the mother, he moves on to one who manages the household. And the point is, just like one who manages a household does not only conservatively conserve one's resources, but wastefully expensing, to almost outgift the other, as it were. This wasteful expenditure is what Tagore thinks is the primary crux of literature. And he goes on to say, and I quote, "The prudent and the expedient worship in one manner, the ecstatic in another manner. The prudent and the expedient worship God with the objective of getting well-being in return." So you pray that, oh, may I be well and all that. Their worship is like lending money on interest. The ecstatic's worship is nothing but wasteful expenditure. When the heart wants to express itself, it does not give any attention to losses. This uncalculating wasteful expenditure is what leads to the aesthetic. So this is the second point. What is world literature? World literature is, and literature itself has to be such something that is somehow connected to wasteful expenditure. This leads me to my third point that Tagore also raises in this particular article, World Literature, as a marker of world literature, is again in resonance of what I was talking about in the last lecture. Literature is excess. So fundamentally, if it is not connected to work, if it does not derive utility, and if it is primarily driven towards wasteful expenditure, we have to theorize literature as excessive. And as Tagore says, we find the power of self-preservation within work. We find the power of self-expression in aesthetic ecstasy. And of course, in brackets, I've put some of the words because so that one who may be aware of classical Indian aesthetics would know that what is the exact word that Tagore used, because in my translation, I would have translated as ecstasy. It's good to know what the word, but it doesn't really make is not of much relevance to the current audience. He goes on to say, self-preservation is what we need. Self-expression is what is in excess of our needs. Self-interest does not want to indulge in wasteful expenditure, and yet ecstatic joy reveals itself only in wasteful expenditure. And this whole idea of excess, where you exceed self-interest and you express yourself precisely in wasteful expenditure, is what therefore forms the crux of literature for Tagore. I skip this short quote, and he goes on to say, what do we get to come face to face with in literature? That which human beings have in abundance, that which is their wealth, that which exceeds all their needs and expediencies, that which has not been exhausted within their worldly lives. So it is precisely being able to approach, being able to access, that excess, what lies beyond our immediate utility-driven drive to a self-preservation, is what literature has to be all about. This makes us move to the fourth point. I told you there are seven specific points that Tagore gives one after the other in determining what is world literature. The fourth point is that literature has to be transcontextual and not context bound. And it says, this is a longish quote, but I can read the whole thing. Precisely Tagore points out that only when a work has exceeded, has gone beyond its immediate context, can it qualify as literature, and which would already be a stepping stone towards world literature, therefore. He goes on to say, one cannot do justice to literature if one were to belittle it to a specific place, time, and people. If we understand that the world being itself is expressing itself through literature, then only will we be able to see what is to be seen in literature. Wherever in literary writing the author has not been but a mere symptom, the writing has got spoiled. Wherever the author has perceived the feelings of the whole of humanity in his or her feelings, has expressed the pains of all humans in his or her writings, there the writing has found a place in literature. Literature has to be seen like this. The world being is my translator of Bishwamanoba, word that he uses, but whatever. The world being is constructing this temple as the master mason. Authors arrive from different places and times to work for him as laborers. The exact plan of the entire building is not in front of any of them. But wherever there is an error, that part breaks off. Every laborer, in exercising his natural strength, has to try to match his composition to the whole, to that invisible master plan. It isn't this that his powers get expressed. And if this happens, then one does not receive the petty salary of an ordinary laborer, but the respect that is due to great masters. So there is as if a whole project that is going on, which is literature, which is literary. And all the contextual, context-bound authors emerging from whichever context seem to be contributing at the end of the day to this grand project, as Tagore sees. And therefore, the fifth point that Tagore goes on to suggest is that literature has to be seen as trans-historical. Again, this is a longish quote, but I'll just give you a certain snippets of it. So he goes on to say, even reading the first couple of lines would be good enough. So if we were to only gather information about how Akbar's empire was, or let's say the history of Gujarat was, or Queen Elizabeth, how her reign was, if that is what we are looking into literature for, then probably we can only satiate our curiosity for information, to know the news, as it were, as Tagore says. But the one who knows that Akbar or Elizabeth are but symptoms, the one who knows that the human being is just trying to bring into fruition his deepest objectives through history, that person has been able to access literature. So literature has to be seen as trans-historical, according to Tagore, and that is the project of world literature, rather than it being tied to any particular historical context, rather than us trying to derive some historical information from literary texts. This leads me to the sixth point that Tagore also makes in the same article, World Literature, which is that literature, therefore, is an alternate world. It's another world. And this word other will become very, very important for us as my talk proceeds. Already the idea of another cosmopolitanism by Saila Ben Habib has been talked about. So as Tagore says, there is a world, the world that we inhabit. And literature seems to be a second world, a parallel world. And he goes on to say, And again, it's a longish quote which I may not afford to read, really. But as he goes on to say, so while walking down the street of a town, you see that people have no free time. The grocer is running his shop, the blacksmith is beating his iron, the porter is carrying his load, the accountant is keeping his book. But there is another thing which you may not literally see, but see it in your hearts. On both sides of the street, through every household, through the shops and markets, through the lanes and by lanes, the flow of ecstatic joy is spreading itself in so many branches, in so many ways, over so much squalor and narrowness. And he goes on to further say that it is only in this that the literary lies. And literature kind of almost, and I move on to the very end of the longish quote. So this second world, that is literature. The second alternate world, alternative to our lived world of labor. That is really what literature is all about. And which leads me to the seventh and the last of Tagore's points, and which almost builds on this idea of the other, on the idea of alterity, and which is something that Goethe had already talked about, which is, and Marx and Engels had also talked about, as we pointed out, that is somehow one should move beyond one's provincial narrow-mindedness, beyond one's national, nation-bound consciousnesses, and one should reach out to the other. Something that I was talking about in the last lecture too, this being able to go beyond identitarianism unto the other. And as Tagore says, and since these are short quotes, I might as well as read them. In any case, this is the last point in this template through Tagore that we are trying to build. He says, the bond that we have with truth in this world is of three types. The bond of prudence, the bond of expedience, and the bond of ecstatic joy. What is this bond of ecstatic joy? It is to know the other as your own and to know your own self for the other. So ultimately, if literature itself is a project to go beyond prudency and expediency, it entails also being able to embrace the other, being able to be in connection with one's alterity, as it were. And he says, with an analogy of form, and the word that he uses is kate, but it's translatable as form. That's all right. I mean, so I've just put in brackets the original word, but that's not of any concern. He goes on to say how we often, in our identitarian attempts to context-bind literary studies, we often think territorially of literature. But that is what we must eschew. That is what we must avoid. And he says, again, as poetically as it gets, the world is not my farm and your farm and his farm. To know the world like that is to know it very provincially. Similarly, literature is not my writings, your writings and his writings. We usually look at literature in this provincial manner. We have to set our goal at liberating ourselves from this provincial narrow-mindedness and seeing the world being in world literature, at accepting a wholeness in every author's works, and seeing in that wholeness the attempt of all human beings at expression. The time has come to take that pledge. And that pledge, as I've already stated before you, is something that he begins his article from, and I thought that I would end this 7-point survey of it with. So he simply says that what you call comparative literature is what I call world literature, but the mandate of world literature, therefore, is this 7-point mandate, which somehow must redeem us from provinciality, but it should lead us to the other somehow. And that is very important, rather than, because the original kind of cosmopolitanism that we saw, it in a way enshrines us into what would be the global self, the global common sense that's in a way the flow of capitalism has through the first world enshrined us into. But it's not that vague first world driven metropolitan cosmopolitanism that Tagore talks about, but rather an alterity driven cosmopolitanism. Anyway, to sum up this particular article and to move on further, to sum up Tagore's article, as I pointed out, that Tagore's view of world literature is thus an ethical project of establishing literature as the very foundation of being human, worldwide, beyond insularisms, beyond sectarianisms, and through 7 points, as I said. First, the difference between useful work, I'm just recapping, okay? The difference between useful work and joyful literature. Second, literature as wasteful expenditure. Third, literature as excess through which humans exceed their limitations. Fourth, literature thus as transcontextual. 5, literature does is transhistorical. 6, literature does is what is capable of creating a second world. And 7, a world that is beyond provincialism, narrow-mindedness, sectarianism. And therefore, this is the mandate for world literature, as Tagore puts it in his 1907 article, World Literature. World literature is thus, and I put it before you, an inutile, excessive gesture of joy that promises to take one beyond narrow presentisms, so here and now presentisms, unto a to come. Because evidently, that which is world literature is never arrived, never already exhausted. It is always already to come, and therefore already always in the domain of the other, beyond both nationalisms and first world cosmopolitanism. And this first world cosmopolitanism, the idea of first world cosmopolitanism, is precisely what I'll build up, vis-a-vis which world literature has to present another cosmopolitanism in the rest of my talk, and which I will try to kind of be fast about, maybe just another 10-15 minutes or so. So to be able to understand this alternate cosmopolitanism, to be able to understand this other kind of cosmopolitanism, we have to again step back into comparative literature, and probably to a certain crisis in comparative literature. So far, what have we talked about? There is indeed a project called World Literature, which probably talks about the excess that literature is, and that literature should not be provincial, literature shouldn't be bound to nationalisms and contextual presentisms, but rather should be about excess, should be about transgression, should embrace the whole world. So far, so good. But in terms of embracing the whole world, we saw that the obvious cosmopolitanism that emerges could as well as be a first world driven cosmopolitanism. An idea of the cosmopolitan that somehow global capital and globalization has made the global common sense. Is there another cosmopolitanism possible? That is our question. So this kind of leads us back to a crisis in comparative literature, and which would precisely answer these questions. As early as in 1963, someone called René Thiomble, he had already pointed out this crisis that has been caused in comparative literature. And I would have read him in English, The Crisis in Comparative Literature. That's the name of his book, which was published originally in 1963. But I'm sure you can read him in French, Comparaison n'est pas raison, La crise de la littérature comparée. You can probably read it up. It's a wonderful book. And he was the first in 1963 to point out that there is a severe crisis in comparative literature, what we do in the name of comparative literature. And that is, it's so Eurocentric. When we talk about comparative literature or world literature, we try to build up a global canon, and which would probably comprise some English authors, some German authors, some French authors, some Italian authors. So it's very Eurocentric, and that seems to be the problem of comparative literature. In 1993, therefore, three decades later, Susan Bassnett, who has been one of the motive forces of comparative literature, she goes on to say, and this is as despondent a quote as it gets, in 1993, Susan Bassnett says, "Today, comparative literature is in one sense dead, in one sense is dead." So the death of the discipline, as it were, death of comparative literature itself by 1993. That is the kind of crisis that a certain kind of Eurocentrism, a certain kind of choosing a kind of cosmopolitanism, which is obviously first world driven, which is a certain metropolitan globalized consciousness driven, as opposed to nationalism, would have pushed comparative literature too. Interestingly, just a decade and a half later, the same Susan Bassnett, in a 2006 article, however, goes on to say, and though it's a longish quote, I'll read it, because she refers to a particular author there, and whom we'll move on to immediately and very fast next. She says, "I've been struggling with comparative literature all my academic life. I use the word struggle advisedly. Engaging with the idea of comparative literature has not been easy, nor, as we move forward in this new century, is it at all clear where the discipline will move next." But then she goes on to say, "Recently, Gayatri Chakraborty Spivak has published a collection of essays entitled Death of a Discipline." I already mentioned this phrase, death of a discipline, and this is indeed the title of a book by Spivak, where she talks about the death of comparative literature and how comparative literature almost has to exhume itself in becoming precisely non-Eurocentric. But let me not preempt, let's just go back to what Susan Bassnett says. So recently, Spivak has published a collection of essays entitled Death of a Discipline, in which she argues that the way forward for a discipline that she perceives to be in decline is to move beyond its Eurocentric origins and to acknowledge a definitive future anteriority, a to-comeness, the same to-comeness that I was talking about earlier, avenir, to come, a will-have-happened quality. A new comparative literature will need to undermine and undo the tendency of dominant cultures to appropriate emergent ones. In other words, it will need to move beyond the parameters of Western literatures and societies and reposition itself within a planetary context. And this word planetary is extremely important because we almost seamlessly therefore move on in following this crisis in comparative literature to the book that was named by Susan Bassnett, Gayatri Chakraborty Spivak's Death of a Discipline. It's actually a collection of three lectures: Crossing Borders, Collectivities, and Planetarity. This very important term which Spivak gives us in 2004, planetarity, as opposed to globalization. Of course, one may say that, well, globe, planet, earth, world, we were talking about world literature in any case, these are synonymous, but they are not. Because the globe is not synonymous to the earth is not synonymous to the planet is not synonymous to the world. So anyway, Gayatri Spivak, in this particular book, talks about how planetarity is different from globalization. Globalization is that kind of a shrinking of the whole world beyond nation states into one cosmopolitan whole that follows the dominant logic of global capital. Whereas planetarity is to see the world, however, as a lived space. And she goes on, let me read her rather than try to paraphrase her. She goes on to say that planetarity is different from globalization, and she says, the globe is on our computers. No one lives there. It allows us to think that we can aim to control it. The planet is in the species of alterity. And alterity becomes a key word again. Belonging to another system, and yet we inhabit it on loan. To be human is to be intended towards the other. If we imagine ourselves as planetary subjects rather than global agents, planetary creatures rather than global entities, alterity remains underived from us. It is not our dialectical negation. It contains us as much as it flings us away. So we, the others of the world, I'm talking about, I mean, almost the we here is Vivek and me, but we, the others of the world, are ourselves kind of not just flung away in conceiving alterity through the planetary lens, but rather become part of it. And therefore she talks about, as opposed to cosmopolitanism, which obviously has not only the vagueness about it that Tagore pointed out, but also a first worldist, metropolitanist kind of tinge about it, she talks instead about the rustic. She talks about the paranational. So it's of course not national. It's of course not nationalism driven. But nor is it cosmopolitan, urban, metropolitan. It is rather the plural rustic earth, rather than the international, cosmopolitan, metropolitan globe, and which becomes Spivak's model for realizing this planetarity. And she goes on to say, the Earth is a paranational image that can substitute for international and can perhaps provide today a display site for the imagination of planetarity. And this possible foregrounding, as she goes on to say, of the rustic, the riffraff, so to say, can lead to a revitalization of the dead discipline, the death of a discipline that she's talking about in the context of, to make for a robust comparative literature. So fighting shy of both nationalism and a certain kind of metropolitan cosmopolitanism, one can rather build up a rustic notion of planetarity, a rustic world literature, comprising the precise riffraffs of the world that would have been left out of the canon building processes that have been primarily Eurocentric. And this leads me to the fag end of my talk to another person who has also theorized on world literature precisely in these lines, and with whose thoughts I'll finish my talk, and that is Ngugi Wa Thiong'o. And he has this fantastic book which was published in 2012. Once again, a compilation of some lectures by him, the Velek Library lectures actually, given in 2010. And it's called Globalectics, Theory and the Politics of Knowing. The same Ngugi Wa Thiong'o, the famous Kenyan author that you're all aware of, has talked about world literature vis-a-vis what he calls global ectics. And this is the term, just like planetarity is the term that Spivak uses, global ectics is the term, almost fusing together globalization and dialectics, a dialectical kind of dealing with globalization. But that is quite besides the point. And this is how Ngugi defines global ectics, but that's a long quote. I can just kind of skip it, or probably just point out some important parts of it. So he talks about how global ectics is trying to understand globalization without conceiving of a center. We were talking about Eurocentrism earlier. Rather, as he says, that just like the spokes of the bicycle, just like the globe, the shape of the globe itself suggests that we are all equidistant from the center. It's not that the center is what really determines it, but like the spokes, all connected to the hub certainly, but the spokes kind of moving off in different directions, and which can therefore bring about a multilogue, as he talks about. And global ectics is the term that he thinks can be some kind of a problematization of globalism and globalization. I have read this book, as most of us do these times, as an EPUB version. So the quotes don't have page, unlike all the other quotes so far, it doesn't have a page number. Not all the other quotes, because I was reading Tagore also online, but this doesn't have page numbers. That's all right. So this is how he defines global ectics. But what is much more important is that in chapter 3 of this book, and that is called Global Ectical Imagination, the World in the Postcolonial. That is where Ngugi talks about world literature, specifically world literature, which is our topic of discussion today, in relation to global ectics. And therefore, let me close my talk with some quotations, as has been my method in this talk. It's a citational method. It's just reading out with a lot of emotion and modulation of voices, very dramatically, one would say, reading out quotes. So similarly, let me not depart from my general strategy, and in the next couple of minutes also do precisely that, to quote Ngugi. So Ngugi goes on to say, at present, the post-colonial is the closest to that Goethean and Marxian conception of world literature, which we've already talked about, because it's a product of different streams and influences from different points of the globe. He thinks that the post-colonial, this unvariegated, plural, polylingual, multi-logical world of the post-colonial is the site. Rather than the Eurocentric canon, it is the post-colonial that is the site of that Goethean and Marxian notion of world literature. Precisely because it emerges from that other cosmopolitanism towards building an other rustic kind of planetary notion of the world. Anyway, so he talks about how post-colonial is international, etc., etc. That's all right. So he says it would be quite productive to look at world literature through post-coloniality. He also goes on to say that the post-colonial is not simply located in the third world, because it would be wrong. All of us are post-colonial, whether we belong to the third world or not. And at the very end of the second quote, he goes on to say that the post-colonial is at the heart of the constitution of Goethe's world literature. And even in theory, he suggests that the post-colonial is the theater, the non-imperial theater, so to say, where even the modern and the postmodern work. Since my talks kind of seem to transition into one another, so the third talk, since that would be problematizing post-colonialism, it's good that we are kind of driving through post-colonialism here. But Ngugi also goes on to say that in such a world of shared intellectual property, organizing the teaching of literature on the principle of national boundaries is outmoded. Something that we've already talked about, because nationalism, sectarianism, identitarianism cannot really lead us very far. And even more so, the export of national literature as a superior knowledge, that my nation is better, I, me, myself. And evidently, we have to move towards, therefore, world literature, but world literature as viewed from a global ectical point of view. Just like Tagore was giving certain analogies, Ngugi also, an author that he is, gives the analogy of the sea and the river. And he says that he talks about how world literature is of the order of the vastness of the sea and the ocean. He says, confronted with the possibility of that reality, and quite frankly its vastness, it is easy for organizers of literary knowledge to stop in fright and stay within a national boundary, taking comfort in the certainty of the structures already tried and passed on as tradition. The traditional organization of literature along national boundaries is like bathing in a river. Instead of sailing in the ocean or trying to contain a reverse or trying to contain a reverse flow within a specific territory. And this is something that Ngugi simply thinks is not something that we should do. And he cries out against such forces which try to bind us to national literatures and which try to therefore kind of restrict us within certain walls, within certain prison walls of national literatures. Whereas the idea is to flow out. But out, as we said, in a world that is globalectical in nature, that is planetary in nature, rather than one that derives from the kind of cosmopolitanism that we were talking about earlier. So he goes on to say, or we could just, maybe towards the middle of the quote, maybe it gets a little interesting. So he of course says that imagination is anti-national. That is what he begins the quote with. And he goes on to say that works of imagination refuse to be bound within national geographies. They leap out of nationalist prisons and find welcoming fans outside the geographic walls. But they can also encounter others who want to put them back within the walls, as if they were criminals on the loose. Equally important, if not more, are approaches to the text. How we read it. Do we want to welcome it, or do we want to put it back into prison, or even a new prison? So Ngugi also takes a very strong position vis-a-vis how we should not be putting a literature back to its prisons, those provincial nationalist prisons. The idea is to let it free. But the idea is to let it free through a globalectic vision rather than one, and one that therefore comprises the post-colonial world, the other world, the rustic world, another cosmopolitanism, one that is beyond the particular metropolitan kind of cosmopolitanism that we were talking about, one that rather faces the other. And he has several other things to say. He compares globalectics with Deleuze and Guattari's rhizome somewhere in the middle of the quote, but I'll just skip it and I'll rather conclude here. So globalectics becomes the way of reading world literature, as Ngugi goes on to say at the very end of this slide. Globalectical reading means breaking open the prison house of imagination built by theories and outlooks that would seem to signify the content within is classified, open to only a few. And this is what Ngugi therefore wants us to do. World literature, and again I'm quoting directly from him, of which the post-colonial is an integral part, is our common heritage as much as the air we breathe. But it becomes world literature only when we are willing to globalectically access it. And therefore, in conclusion, finally, something that I was rhetorically stating in the last lecture too, that we are passing through extremely troubled times. And all around us, there are these sectarian identity assertions, and there are quasi-fascisms, and on the one hand, so utter sectarianisms, and on the other hand, there is this promise of a vague first world cosmopolitanism. We'll all become global citizens, we'll all lead our lives in the same way, because that in a way actually just skirts the real issues and makes us almost move into a make-believe bubble of affluence of the few. So as opposed to both of these, world literature becomes an ethical means of leading one beyond both these cesspools, both of the insular identitarian and the dilettante, metropolitan, cosmopolitan here and now, to the promise of a truly cosmopolitical democracy to come, as it were. It's always other-driven. It's always, and that is the relevance of Tagore's vision of world literature, which I spent a maximum time on, because it almost forms a blueprint for this non-instrumental, non-identitarian, non-nationalistic, and non-cosmopolitan, and yet cosmopolitical pursuit of literature and culture, which can attempt to show us the way out of the sectarianism and identitarianism, as well as the indifference and cynicism. We were talking about cynicism also in the last class, that plague our society today. And Spivak's idea of connecting comparative literature to planetarity and Ngugi's idea of connecting world literature to globalectics allow us to do so by connecting to literatures of those other worlds, the rustic as opposed to the cosmopolitan, ones that are otherwise than centralizing. So thank you very much for your patience, and it was a pleasure sharing these quotes and thoughts with you. And of course, I've taken more than what I thought would, but we still have enough time to discuss. Thank you. Thank you very much.